This is episode 183, recorded October 28th, 2013.
Greetings, everyone.
Hi.
Sorry about last week.
Russ was very, very sick.
I'm not doing that great this week either, but I'm doing a lot better.
He can kind of talk now, although there might, you know, he might cough. We'll try to not cough in the microphone.
Right.
Yes. So, we have Sean in Asheville, North Carolina, and Dr. Bob and in Boston, and Tom in Provo, and Tony. No, Tony in New York. And before we start with those, we had another donation, too.
We did.
Can I say his name? Is that... I don't know if you put it on the paper, so
Say his last name.
I don't have his last name. Yeah. Chris in New Hampshire, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So we are up to 105 now towards the field recorder, so yay!
Yeah, we're almost there. Mm-hmm.
What are we, like halfway or something?
About halfway. We'll need around 200 to get it, including all the stuff we need. Mm-hmm. So
it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. We're getting very close.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's jump right in with Sean. North Carolina, he says, I was just watching my 75-gallon and noticed some movement on the bottom and found a couple baby Corys. It was Corydoras
palliatus.
Okay. He says, stoked! I've seen them breeding on multiple occasions and tried following the female to see where she was putting the eggs, but I haven't figured it out and assumed the eggs were getting eaten or something. Nice outcome. I'm also including a snap of some of the Danio margaritatus.
Yeah, going celestial to, pearl danios.
Oh, okay. Going to try my hand at selling them. If that doesn't work out, into the 75 they go. Don't know if you recall my previous note about putting the angels with the danios and the tetras, with me thinking it might work out better this time. You were supposed to say, of course it will go better this time. I was thinking it was a shame I never had the Cory babies when I introduced the angels and assumed I'd never see any after that. Pleasant surprise.
You know, it sometimes happens that way. I've had several times where I set up a tank to breed something, and I think after a long time trying to do it, I said, okay, this isn't working. I better change something. And so I go down to switch things out of the tank and see babies.
Mm-hmm. They've just been hiding in their little nursery.
Yep. So that's cool on the Corys. It's always nice to be surprised by fry. I love that feeling.
It's a good thing.
And I'm glad that they have withstood the attentions of the angels.
Hopefully that continues. So he sent us some pictures.
He sent us some pictures, which we will put on the page so everyone can check them out.
Okay. And Dr. Bob in Boston. He says, I apologize ahead of time for the length of this submission. If you find the volume too great for one contribution, please feel free to address the topics over multiple shows. And I think just in the interest of Russ not having to talk too much at once yet, we're going to cut his email in half, correct?
And talk about more of it next week.
Yes. So we'll do half of it this week and half of it next week. So. Yes. So, first half. He says, during my research on the nitrogen cycle, I came across a good resource that discusses products and their appropriate use. It's user-friendly, but very detailed. And he sent a link, and
we can put
that up. As I hoped, my tank cycling took just 8 days using a preliminary Fritzheim 7 dose on the first day and ammonia dosing daily. Now, what's Fritzheim 7? Is that one of the...
Yeah, bacterial products.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 8 days, that's nice.
Yeah.
On the eighth day, I dosed the ammonia. So, I just had a funny thought.
What?
On the eighth day, Dr. Bob looked at his tank and said, it was good.
Okay.
Okay, sorry. Okay. On the eighth day, I dosed the ammonia in the morning and found that the water tested clean by late afternoon. I did use a 200-watt heater in the tank and set it to about 80 degrees for the duration of the cycling.
Mm-hmm, that helps.
I'm having deja vu with this email.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's weird.
We haven't had it before, though.
No. But, okay, that's odd. I'm using the Aquatech hang-on-back filter, but since it doesn't have a bio wheel, I thought that maybe the biofiltration would benefit from the addition of an air stone in each of the filter chambers. Do you think that this is working to sufficiently oxygenate the bacteria growing on the filter media the way a bio wheel would?
I think it'd certainly help. I don't think it'll be quite... to the degree that a bio wheel would, just because the bio wheel is basically out of the water most of the time, and so oxygen is really not as limited. But when you're using an air stone, you are increasing the amount of times that water is getting turned over, so it is going to increase the oxygen somewhat. I just don't think it'll be as much.
But it's better than not doing it if you don't have
it. Better than not doing it, yeah.
Bio wheel. Okay.
I would say so.
It says, my pond biotope now has 5 2-inch banded sunfish and a 1-inch swamp darter that was an unintentional catch. It probably was in the vegetation I collected. Since it is so tiny, it is hard to locate in a 55-gallon tank, but I'm hoping that the little guy will find what he needs to survive.
It's kind of cool.
What's a swamp darter?
It's a wee little native fish. There are so many. I mean, what do you want me to tell you
about? I don't know. I've never heard of a swamp. It's kind of a fun name.
It is. Like, darters are a very big
Luke part Skywalker of the, and swamp rats back home, you know?
Yeah. The native... how can I say it? Part of the native fish hobby here in the U.S., darters are a very big part of it.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of them have really bright colors.
Why do they call them darters? Is that just how they swim? They just dart around the tank?
It comes from their swimming habits. Yeah.
Okay. Are they kind of just fish colored?
No, actually, a lot of darters can be quite brightly colored. Mm-hmm. After we're done with the podcast, I'll show you some pictures.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we should put some up on the page too.
Yeah.
For other dart ignorant people like myself. I don't know. You guys probably all know what it is. I don't know. I learn new stuff every week.
So do I.
Okay. Since it is... Oh, I read that. He's so tiny. Some other hitchhikers on the plants included a few small pond snails. So much for controlling that aspect of this biotope. Russ, I'm hoping that Kelly can turn the page that you are right about the fish snacking on little snails. I'm feeding the fish chopped red worms, superworms, or darkling beetle larvae, grindle worms, and black soldier fly larvae, all of which they accept greedily. They remind me a lot of the cichlids I used to keep 100 years ago. They follow me around and flare their fins when I open the hood. And I included a picture of one, so we can put that up too.
Yeah. Oh, I was thinking too, even though this is a biotope setup, and I'm sure he's turned the heater down now, if your temperature is in the 70s right now, you could put an assassin snail in there just to get rid of the snails and then take it out.
That's true.
Just think of it as a, you know, kind of a surgical attack against the snails, and then you're removing it. You don't have to put more than one in, so you're not getting a population of assassin snails.
But it will eat them all.
Yeah, you put it in there, let them eat it all, and then take it out. Mm-hmm. As long as the temperatures in the 70s are, you know.
It'd be like Halloween and Thanksgiving for that assassin snail.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. In thinking ahead as to my maximum bioload, I have the following thought. Since sunfish tend to be somewhat oval in shape, the number of 3-inch fish in the 55 tank should probably be less than 3-inch fish that are long and thin like the darter. I'm thinking no more than 12 of these 3-inch sunfish total. As for the cleanup crew, I'm apprehensive about putting a Mad Tom catfish in, but maybe a dojo loach might work. Yes, that would be an import. I also wonder how whisker shrimp might fare in this tank. I know that both the loach and the shrimp can tolerate high 50s temperatures. What do you think? Am I messing up the biotope?
Well, I think that just depends on how much of a purist you want to be. But, I mean, certainly dojo loaches would do fine in there, but in terms of how accurate you are geographically, I mean, that is messing with it a bit, but that's entirely up to you. It depends, really. Do you enjoy it? Is it fun?
You want to hear my take on that?
What?
Do dojo loaches match the color scheme? Do they look like they fit color-wise in with the other fish? Because then nobody will ever know that they don't actually belong in that biotope.
Well, if he has another nympha person over there, a native fish person, you know, over there, then
well,
be,
just tell him
I can't believe you
that
have something
the dojo loaches have their green cards, and so it's okay.
Okay. Well, dojo loaches are, I'm colorblind, but they're kind of a mottled brown color.
Okay.
So they look, you know.
There you go.
Mottled brown. I love dojos.
You can go a long way with mottled brown. Brown is like, brown goes with everything, right?
Okay, I guess so.
Except maybe, well, no, brown went with pink in the 60s.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know if we're going back to the 60s in the fish tank or not, but.
I don't know. My baby.
Send us a picture.
Yeah, there you go. And Kelly can tell you where the color scheme fits. But I just say.
You might want to get some throw pillows in there, too.
Are you having fun with it? Is it working for you? If it's working for you, then I would say go for it.
Yeah. Okay. My vermiculture worm bins consist of 3 30-gallon storage bins. The bottom one has no holes and is intended to collect the worm tea. Hooray for worm tea! The middle one is the active culture, and after about 2 months, I will start the top one by filling it with bedding and beginning to place the kitchen scraps in the top. The worms will migrate from the middle bin to the top bin to get to the food, leaving the middle with the finished worm castings and maybe a few stragglers. The idea is to keep the rotation going to continue the cycle of production. I have included a good link for those who are interested in vermiculture for kitchen composting and or fish food. And we can put that link up too.
Yes.
If we had room in our kitchen. But we don't. I was going to include the grindleworms in my worm bins, but I was concerned about losing track of them in a busy 30-gallon culture. So I'm using some ventilated plastic takeout containers so that I can find them for use as fish food. This also gives me control of what the grindles eat. I'm using dry cat food so that they will have a high-protein diet. I know you can feed them baby cereal or oatmeal, but I'm thinking that carnivorous fish need more protein and less carbs in their diet. Am I off base here?
All right, I've actually found that the grindleworms do better on kitten food than they do on scraps. Mm-hmm. Their yields are higher, and I can give them a straight diet of nothing but kitten food. Generation after generation, they do fine on it. So
that's
I would say
what we use, yeah.
That's fine. The only thing is, the worms do tend to get a little greasier on that diet.
In terms of more
like
fat?
Externally, they get layers of grease on
interesting.
Them. And you know they're fatty anyway dietarily mm-hmm. for the fish. As far as they're concerned, they're going to have fat in them anyway, a lot. And so they're not good as a sole diet. You know they're good as a fat source, including you know they're also proteinaceous. But the thing is, rinse them off well. On a diet like that, rinse them off well anyway.
Rinse the worms off?
Yeah. Put them in a container and let them sink to the bottom. Pour that water off. Do that a couple times before you feed
and
them
it some. Rinses some of the grease off?
The grease floats the top. You pour it off.
Mm, okay. Interesting.
Helps keep that out of
the
tank.
They don't drown?
Not easily. You can keep grindleworms in water for 3 hours or so,
wow.
and they don't usually drown in that
How
period.
How long do you usually soak them when you're trying to get the grease off?
Not anywhere that long. I just rinse them off a few times.
For a few minutes?
Yeah, but I've okay. kept them underwater for a couple of hours, and they don't die.
Well,
very fast. And they will eventually if you leave them there for a long time. But
I guess that... Oh, excuse me. That makes sense since we're feeding them in the fish tank. They don't drown. There's my brain kicking in for you. It's been a long week for me, too.
Yeah, it's been a very long week.
Okay, and we will get to the rest of his fabulous email next week.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And one more thing
yes?
I just wanted to say about the worms. Just for fun, I would suggest tossing a clump of the grindleworms into your red worm container, just for fun. See what happens.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
You might end up seeing a whole bunch of them near the surface, which is what I tended to see when I did that. So, yeah, just it's worth a shot. And if you never see them again, you never see them again, but you still have your other grindleworms. But if you know, if it works for you, I hope it works for you as it has worked for me, then you won't be sorry.
That's true. Okay, we are going to go to Tom in Provo. And he says, Dr. Bob's field work in preparation for his biotope was heartening. One of the advantages and or disadvantages, depending on how you look at it, of the hobby is that with the internet, an aquarist does not have to leave the house for so much as a trip to the fish store or to a club meeting. I have resolved to take time next spring to explore some of the local aquatic environments and perhaps to collect an item or two, remembering, as you always remind us, to check local laws. I don't suppose that much collected in Utah would do well with a tropical aquarium. Are there aquarium-appropriate fish other than the gambusia in Utah waters? Interesting inverts that could be kept in a cold water aquarium?
Well, there are certainly critters out there that you can keep. When we're not talking about laws, of course, right now. I'm talking about practicality of being kept in an aquarium, and other than in Gambusia, there are species that can be kept. For example, I had a friend who caught a sunfish. I can't remember what kind of sunfish it was. This has been years. But he kept a sunfish for a long time in his aquarium that he caught here in Utah. There are other species, too. It's too bad the crayfish here are illegal because... they're you know, you can catch crayfish here that'll do well in an aquarium, but they're illegal to keep.
Why are they illegal to keep?
Just one of the fishing laws. Hmm. You can collect them, you have to, like, open them up and eat them on site, basically, cook them there.
So you can catch them and eat them, but you can't catch them and keep them.
That's my understanding of the law, yes.
That makes all kinds of logical sense.
So I caught some when I was a kid and kept them. I didn't know about the law. I found out about it later. But
you were a kid.
Yeah, I was a kid, and that doesn't really excuse it. But
yes, it does. You're a kid. Kids are exempt. Plus, This is reminding me of that story from when you were a kid of the park ranger who was mis-IDing the fish, but you knew what they were. I don't remember how old you were. You were like, I don't know, 10 or something at Utah Lake.
Oh, I was catching gambusias.
You were catching gambusia, and he thought they were what?
I don't know what he thought. I don't remember. He couldn't figure out what I was trying to say or something. But anyway,
I remember you told me the story, and like he didn't know what they were. And
yeah, well.
You were the kid, and you knew what they were.
Yeah, but he wouldn't let me catch them.
Silly man.
But anyway.
I hope he's listening right now, and I'm calling him a silly man.
Hence the importance of checking your local laws so you don't get in trouble.
Well, hence the importance of park rangers actually knowing what species are which, too.
Yeah. Okay. But there are plenty of species that do well. There are interesting snails that you can find here. There are lots of things. So, yeah, it's worth a try looking into that a little bit.
Sorry about that.
So there are some things that are worth trying in Utah if you can find anything that's legal, basically.
Okay. He says, I successfully changed my substrate from gravel to fluorite using your directions. The process was messy and time-consuming, but not difficult. Immediately after, the water looked as if I had collected it from our notoriously murky Utah lake and didn't fully clear up for a couple of days. That's pretty normal, yeah.
Yep, it is.
The fish, however, seemed indifferent. Even though the Java fern is not really planted since the change of substrate, it's flourishing. Some nutrients from the fluorite probably make their way into the water column. I have also added wisteria and dwarf baby tears. Wisteria... This is not the wisteria that I'm thinking of that has purple flowers and, like, trails down and is gorgeous.
There's an aqua. Yeah,
different plant. This is an aquatic wisteria.
Yeah. Okay. And it's true. Some of the minerals from the fluorite do make their way into the water column.
Okay. I hope to add additional plants and start the CO2 injection and ferts this week. That's fertilizers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think fertilizers sounds a little better than ferts. That's CO2 already. Sorry, that was awful. Okay. I have a vague and probably incorrect feeling that starting one without the other would be somehow unbalanced.
No, in a way, that is true, because if you start fertilizing when you don't have the CO2 to back it up, you could get algae going. So,
there you go.
I mean, and not that that will happen necessarily. It's depending, you know, you can still balance it out so it'll work. But I kind of agree. It's going to be easier to do the CO2 and the fertilizers together, probably.
Okay. It says, the mollies in my tank are constantly grazing on and picking at the plants, including the roots of the Java fern and frog bit, making life particularly difficult for the frog bit. I would feel better about this if I knew that all their chomping was also removing algae. On balance, do mollies help a planted tank more than they harm it? Perhaps there are too many variables to provide a definitive answer.
Probably true. I know that some people, I've heard of people keeping mollies, like one or two in a big tank, because they specifically handle types of algae and whatnot. But, yeah, I don't know what the formula would be for how many mollies are beneficial per, you know, gallon of planted tank and what types of plants. And I think that too many variables thing is probably applicable. But my understanding is that they're good about picking, like, fuzzy algae off of things in general, so, and I've seen them do that myself, so.
That's good.
Yeah, I think they're probably beneficial. Okay. Okay, well, hopefully that was helpful, and hopefully I'm still coherent. Kelly has had to depart, but I'm going to finish the rest of the show myself. We have, I like what he says here. This is what Tom says. So the fish is with me, as it will be with everyone who uses that donate button. So I echo your sentiment there. Please, everyone who would like to do so, please help us out. We are close. All right. So our next contributor is Tony in New York. He says, greetings, Aquarimax. Well, I took a look at one of my tanks today, and lo and behold, there's a film at the surface. I have almost no agitation in this tank, and I've been reading up on surface scum. Most of the sites say it is normal and nothing to worry about. Just get an airstone in there and you're good to go. But being a faithful Aquarimax listener, I'm trying to decide if it is something more sinister, the dreaded mycobacteriosis or fish TB. So first, this is my shrimp tank. The shrimp population is very low. They have been perishing. And I also have two zebra nerite snails in here. Also, I have Java moss and it is a beautiful tank. I have held off on introducing more red cherry shrimp as I I'm wondering if I should consider shutting the tank down. The idea of breeding tuberculosis in my aquarium is not as much fun as the idea of breeding shrimp. I can see why. The idea that I can get infected by my tank is even less appealing.
But is this what I have? Is the film always mycobacteriosis, TB, or is the film sometimes just random benign film? Have been using a paper cup during each water change to remove the scum, which is sort of oil-like and also has teeny white dots floating in it at each water change. I've been washing my hands thoroughly after caring for the tank each time. That was a good procedure. After hearing about how important it is to avoid flushing an infected fish, now I wonder about the wisdom of flushing the potentially infected water after water changes, too. Is it time to shut this tank down? I think the matter of adding an air stone is easy, but even if the film vanishes, I will still know that the tank is infected. But is it a virulent disease or just scum? Okay, thank you for your thoughts. Well, let's talk about this a little bit. The scum itself is not mycobacteriosis. However, oily scum at the top of the tank tends to attract this type of bacteria, mycobacteria. So it is possible that there are some environmental mycobacteria residing in this scum. They may not be at levels that are going to be causing problems for inhabitants, and it's difficult to tell unless you notice you have inhabitants with issues. I would make sure to get rid of the scum, though, and if you keep the scum, you could, are able to eliminate and or keep the scum in check, then you probably don't need to worry a whole lot about the bacteria reaching levels that would infect tank inhabitants. Not that this is a hard and fast rule, but that in general is the case. Well, maybe I shouldn't say in general in the case, but you're considerably lessening the risk to your aquarium inhabitants by keeping that scum in check. If there is a scum there, the fish are going to be eating from the surface and ingesting some of that scum, and the likelihood that they are ingesting pathogenic levels of mycobacterium are higher. So removing it with a cup is a good thing to do. If you can get an air stone in there to get it bubbled off, that's another good thing to do. So basically what's happening there, if you're breaking it up enough to get good bacteria up there to be taking care of the scum and breaking it down, breaking the oils down so that the mycobacteria don't have anything to hang around in, that would be helpful too. And it's possible that you have few, if any, mycobacteria in that the scum, but it's just the fact that the oil is there, it's kind of like a waiting invitation. Whether or not that invitation has been accepted is the question that we can't answer. I would say just definitely get rid of it, and if you get the scum to a point where you don't see it anymore, then you're probably safe. But one can never be 100% certain. And yeah, it's true what you say about flushing the potentially infected water. That could be a possible issue, but dumping it outside, that's what some people do. Wow, when it comes to mycobacteria, it's just, is there anything you can do that's completely safe? It's hard to think of something that is completely safe. He does say this. He says, P.S. I don't know if I should be concerned about the gradual shrimp die-off. The parameters seem good, and I doubt they have long lifespans anyway. I've had these for about a year and a half, and they've never bred in this tank. Well, a year and a half is pretty respectable for a red cherry shrimp. The life in the tank shows no symptoms, but of course I'm not sure how they might manifest in non-fish anyway, if at all. And that is a good point. Apparently, from what I have been able to determine, the fish TB doesn't manifest in a symptomatic way in shrimp. So, that's a tricky one. But I would say first line of defense is get rid of the scum, and then you're probably okay. But the alternative of getting rid of the tank is that's always an option. But if you're not getting any symptoms, then maybe it would be overkill. But hopefully those are some thoughts that may help you come to a decision. And we are about done for this week, I think, ladies and gentlemen. So may the fish, and not the scum, be with you.